Yeah, thanks everyone for coming, and hopefully those watching on Zoom can hear me. If not, maybe Craig will come in over the loudspeakers or something and tell me, but everything should be good. So I'm going to tell you guys about some work here, and I was actually debating talking about one of two different things. So I'm going to end up trying to tell you about this project that's supposed to come out soon. But I'm also working on things that might be of interest to people here about gauging things in the many, many copies of the Ising model with Brandon Rahon and Yifan Wang. So if anybody, doesn't care about this but cares about, gauging non-invertible defects in many, many copies of the Ising model, I'm happy to talk about that as well. And yes, I've heard, so let's see. So the main point of the talk is going to be a paper with Davide and Jingsheng Wu. And I printed the paper just to prove it exists. And if people want to talk about it, we can talk about it after. It says 2403.tomorrow because originally I had scrambled to try and get the paper done for this conference. And it was 1:55 on Friday. And I was getting ready to submit for the 2 p.m. deadline. And it was literally 1:55. And I got to the last stage of the archive submission. And I realized I can't cross-list to MathQA. So yes, we're either going to submit today or tomorrow. So it'll either appear tomorrow or be submitted tomorrow. So that's the dot tomorrow. So it's intentionally vague. And so the bulk of this talk is mostly going to be based on this work here, higher operations and perturbation theory, but it's also related to some earlier work with Kasia Budzik, Brian Williams, and Matthew Yu, and some earlier work also with the same authors. And it originally came from studying supersymmetric quantum field theories and their twists, but I really want to emphasize that many of the things I'm going to talk about today are actually really not about supersymmetric quantum field theories and not even about holomorphic topological quantum field theories. It just turns out that those are places where these tools were best understood previously. Oh, okay. So yeah, let me unlock the iPad here. All right, so here's kind of the idea is today I want to discuss some ideas from formal deformation theory in quantum field theory. And so in particular, the flavor of a kind of problem in formal deformation theory is you pick some sort of algebraic gadget A, okay? And you want to understand what kind of structures are similar to A inside of, the category of gadgets of the shape A. And if you're a mathematician, this is actually about as abstract and mathematical and precise as I'm going to get. I'm going to use words like gadgets and wave my hands. So for example, a concrete problem would be like if you had an algebra and it has some sort of multiplication rule, let's say, AB, you might ask what kind of multiplication rules you can make from AB. So you might try to define a new operation called like A star B, where it's like AB plus maybe some small deformation that depends on A and B. And you might try to ask, okay, if you started with an associative algebra or something, and then you deform its multiplication rule, when is this A star B also an associative algebra or something? And those are the kind of flavor of problems that you're going to study in formal deformation theory. And an example of such a problem, usually what happens is then you'll find that the solutions to these kind of problems have some sort of cohomological flavor. And a familiar example to many of the people in this audience would be Occhiano rigidity, which famously says there are only finitely many fusion categories with a given fusion ring. And physicists usually cite this as the reason that there's the structure of some finite collection of topological defect lines and their associated Hooft anomalies or their generalizations are preserved along RG flows because they're sort of too rigid, they have no sort of deformations. This is usually what people say. And what I want to argue for you guys today is that QFTs have some sort of higher multilinear K-area operations, which I'll just refer to throughout the rest of the talk as brackets. And they look vaguely like this, some sort of brackets. And these brackets satisfy various consistency relations amongst themselves. So these can be sort of thought of as, if you think of brackets you might be familiar with out in the wild, it'd be something like a Lie bracket, which is a two-area operation. And then the Lie algebra satisfies some sort of relation that relates nested brackets. So it satisfies a Jacobi identity, for example. And I want to argue that these sort of brackets that eat K objects appear naturally in quantum field theory, and they're sort of higher homotopical versions of the Jacobi identity which appear. And if we have time, I would like to assert near the end that these these sort of consistency relations amongst these brackets seem actually to be strong enough in some cases, like for 4D supersymmetric quantum field theories where they appear, to essentially bootstrap all K-area operations. So these consistency relations seem quite powerful. And these brackets control lots of interesting properties of the quantum field theory, like its deformations, some operator product expansions and generalized notions of operator product expansions, and anomalies. And we'll really focus on the example of anomalies here today. Okay, and I guess for this audience, I was kind of interested in seeing how many mathematicians and how many condensed matter physicists and other there would be here today. So I would really like to stress that, you know, we see a lot of infinity algebras appearing, lots of factorization algebras, and lots of operads. Although I'm not really going to say these things too explicitly, but if you are familiar with these kind of subjects, then hopefully you'll just kind of see that underlying most of the talk. So if you're familiar with, for example, Costello and Williams' way to associate a factorization algebra with any quantum field theory, then maybe lots of these things will be familiar to you. And if you're a high energy physicist or a mathematician who studied twisted supersymmetric quantum field theories, you may recognize lots of these brackets as coming from descent relations. And that's actually how these projects originally started. We were studying twisted supersymmetric quantum field theories, and we were basically generalizing these descent relations. But I really want to stress that this talk is not limited to these twisted supersymmetric quantum field theories. This is about quantum phases of matter, and while there are some, you know, interesting phases of matter that have supersymmetry, I just want to say, like, things are more general than that. However, in the case that you have a supersymmetric quantum field theory and it can be twisted and you get a holomorphic or topological theory from the twist, or in the case that you just started with a holomorphic or topological theory, it turns out we can take these structures very far and we can do some pretty heavy computations. So that's kind of the outline of the talk. I have to unlock my slides every single time. So the general structure is, I'm going to remind everybody how the beta function works and how BRST symmetry works in quantum field theory. Shouldn't require anything more than like some Peskin and Schroeder background. Then I'm going to introduce a thing that I call the eta function as opposed to the beta function and the higher brackets that are associated with it. I'm going to show that the eta function is actually computable, and I'll compute it and show you the kind of data it has. I'm going to flash some generalizations to other scenarios, and I'll just talk very hand-wavy, and you can, again, come talk to me and we can go through the paper and talk about some examples. And then finally, I'll survey some results and some of the strong applications to holomorphic topological scenarios. So if you were to come away from the talk today, I would hope that you would know that there's a thing called the eta vector, and it exists, and it is computable. I'd hope that you know that it sort of contains information about anomalies and operator product expansions and possibly more information. And again, if there's time, I'll talk about a particular sort of non-renormalization theorem for holomorphic topological theories. So that would be like, you know, Chern-Simons theory, for example, or chiral algebras. Okay, so the first things first, let's talk about this thing I call the eta function. So the eta function, so let's just back up more generally. So given a quantum field theory, T, one of the key properties of quantum field theory is that quantum field theories can be deformed. Basically, every observable in a quantum field theory can be understood as coupling the theory to some sort of external system. So for example, a local operator can just be intuitively thought of as a little speck that deforms the quantum field theory in a neighborhood of a point. A line operator is a little speck of junk that's landed in your system, and it's just, you know, a speck of junk that's sitting there for some amount of time, and it deforms the quantum field theory in the neighborhood of the speck of junk. Something like a local conserved current is something that tells you when it's in a correlation function, it tells you kind of how that correlation, so pretend you had a correlation function that was like something like J01...ON. This is essentially telling you what the correlation function of O1...ON looks like in the presence of like a very small A background. So very small background A, because J couples to A. So it's like, you know, it's the generating function for correlation functions that look like this. So yes, quantum field theory is all about deformations. And in particular, we can consider taking some theory, let's say schematically we draw it with an action T, and we could imagine that we turn on some deformations, we turn on some interactions, just like this, we schematically write it like this. And what we can imagine is that we're in some sort of theory space, that there's a point T, this is like our theory, it's a point, and that turning on these interactions, the interactions are like little tangent vectors, and so we're sort of studying a neighborhood a neighborhood of this quantum field theory T. So in this case, these little GI, the couplings, are essentially coordinates on this theory space. And throughout this entire talk, I'm going to work perturbatively in the couplings. So I'm going to essentially, you know, consider all of my quantities. I'm going to consider them all to be formal power series in these couplings GI. Some people use the word infinitesimal coupling, but that also leads people to believe that I'm taking things to be like G squared is equal to zero. I just really mean that any quantity involving G is not going to be, you know, finite. It's going to be some formal power series in G. Is this all kind of good? Every time you see the word formal, you should really just think in perturbation theory, okay? But not just tree level. Okay, there have been issues. Okay, and so if we consider this, what we're actually studying is we're studying a formal pointed neighborhood, dt of t. And this consists of all effective quantum field theories obtained by a perturbative deformation of T. It's pointed. Pointed just means that there's a distinguished point in this little red blob here. There's a distinguished point. It's T. It's where all the couplings are zero. And it's formal because, again, we only consider deformations in an infinitesimal neighborhood of T. We're not, you know, considering finite coupling or something like this. And so, again, consider formal as a synonym for infinitesimal. Just working in perturbation theory. Oh, I'm on here. Okay, so what's the deal with all this? So the beta function. So generically in quantum field theory, we want to compute phenomena at different energy or length scales. However, a generic quantum field theory is just simply not scale invariant. So free theories are scale invariant, but a generic quantum field theory is not. Some other theories are also scale invariant. Some very important ones are also scale invariant. So the point of view we usually take, following, for example, Wilson, is that we can trade a scale transformation on T for a change of the couplings, right? So in a Wilsonian scheme, we know that we can integrate out UV degrees of freedom, and then that modifies the couplings of our theory. And you know, you could even say that figuring out sort of the exact RG flow details of a quantum field theory is a large step towards solving the theory, because quantum field theories, at least for some people, are essentially defined in the UV. So understanding what it looks like in the IR is, you know, kind of solving the quantum field theory, if you will. So what we normally do is, we usually encode the infinitesimal scale transformations in some vector field on the theory space, and that's called the beta function. So we just do some sort of transformation. It changes the couplings. We do a scale transformation. Generic points, not scale invariant, so we move a little bit in the manifold. When you do a scale transformation, that generates a flow on the manifold, and there's some beta function associated with that that tells you if you're at a point labeled by, you know, some couplings G, which way that vector is pointing. Okay? And so I've drawn a picture here, and then I started to realize as I filled in the arrows that it takes a lot of work to draw a whole vector field, because you've got to put an arrow on every point. So there's a picture of a vector field. And so typically what we do is we perturb around some scale invariant theory where beta is equal to zero. And then, you might say, like, what if you wanted to say, if we deform some quantum field theory and we deform it by some interactions and the resulting theory is still scale invariant, well, then that'll be some zero of this thing called the beta function. Okay? So these coefficients of this beta vector field are also often what we call beta functions. And of course, these things are also going to be, because again, I'm working in perturbation theory, these things will be understood to be formal power series in these couplings G. And in, you know, some, I'll call it like a Polchinski-esque scheme, that in a Polchinski scheme, you know, these beta function coefficients are like, you take the coupling and you take a derivative of it with respect to your UV cutoff scale, and that tells you this beta function. And it's kind of obvious from this perspective that beta functions are scheme dependent, because, you know, they're just coefficients of a vector field on the space of quantum field theories. So of course, you know, they're kind of trivially scheme dependent, because you could just do some sort of change of basis. And you could also, for example, even if you had only one coupling, like for example in Yang-Mills theory, you've only got one coupling, still it's very scheme dependent, because what you call G, I might call some complicated linear combination G plus G, you know, some C1 times G squared plus C2 times G cubed, so on and so forth. So there's lots of redefinitions you can do. However, the beta function is not completely useless, because of course it's still exactly zero in any scheme at a scale invariant point. And there still is some scheme independent information in it. So for example, famously in Yang-Mills theory, for some reason, the one and two loop beta functions are scheme independent. You can't do any redefinition of couplings or anything like that to change the one and two loop beta functions. And the one loop beta function is also related in any quantum field theory to the three-point functions in the CFT that you're perturbing around. So there's lots of scheme-independent information in the beta functions, and it's still a very interesting quantity. It tells you if your theory is UV-free or you know, IR-free, things like that. So the idea is regardless, what we usually do is we will take some sort of interactions, add it to our quantum field theory, and then the coefficients, beta ig, like I said, are power series in g, and we can compute those in any way we want in some scheme. Maybe, you know, maybe some terms deep over here in, at high orders of g, maybe they're kind of not meaningful, or they're not meaningful without telling me what scheme you're in. But the first term is going to be something like this. It's going to be proportional. The linear term is going to be essentially related to your dimension minus your classical scaling dimension. So it tells you, for example, if this term is non-vanishing, it tells you that classically your operator had some sort of scale that didn't jive with the dimension. So, you know, we usually study marginal interactions where this term is just trivially zero. To say it differently, this term tells you that classically, if you added some interaction where delta I was not d classically, that you're breaking scale symmetry right at the linear order. You're breaking it essentially classically. And then, of course, higher order terms in the beta function tell you whether or not there are extra quantum corrections that cause you to break scale symmetry. So, you know, typically what we do is we're clever enough to say, okay, I'm not going to compute the beta function for a relevant operator or something like that. Of course, it breaks scale symmetry. What you'll do is you'll consider some sort of marginal interaction, and you'll compute the beta function for that marginal thing, and you'll see if quantum mechanically some scale is generated by quantum effects. Okay, so these higher order terms measure the violation of scale symmetry by quantum effects. So hopefully that is all familiar to folks. People know what a beta function is. The next thing I'd like to say is I'd like to pause everything there, and I'd just like to hold that in our memory banks, and I'd like to turn to something else. So perhaps when people took a course on quantum field theory, they remember quantizing non-abelian gauge theories. So when you quantize a non-abelian gauge theory, you remember that it was quite hard. So the reason it was quite hard is because non-abelian gauge theories are formulated redundantly in exchange for other nice properties. So, you know, you wanted this nice covariant local field theoretic description, and in exchange you had to use some sort of field theoretic description, and it was redundant. And so when you are trying to do something like this path integral, something, let's say, like this, and I just will bundle all those fields up schematically into this capital phi from now on. When you bundle all these things up into a path integral, there are sort of some unphysical degrees of freedom in your Lagrangian. And so what you have to do is you have to introduce some Fadeev-Popov ghosts. You have to gauge fix, and you introduce some Fadeev-Popov ghosts, and they're kind of, you think about them as containing some sort of anti-degrees of freedom that compensate for the fact that certain gauge degrees of freedom in this A are not supposed to enter into things, okay? So again, if that was all just gibberish, you could just say you started with an action that looked vaguely like this. You gauge fix, and you introduce some ghosts. You turn some determinants into some ghosts. And what you do is then you do some manipulations, and you end up with an action like this. I should stress that this action maybe like looks very sophisticated or scary or something like that, but it's really not. Here's your original action. This is usually what's called an auxiliary field. Its equations of motion are simply taking this FA of phi here. FA of phi is your gauge fixing condition. So when BA is on shell, it's some auxiliary field that just says enforce the gauge fixing condition. And then B and C are some anti-ghosts and ghosts. Okay, this is all hopefully standard stuff. And so when you do this, you have this sort of gauge fixed action, and I've written it in a very general form. You find that this gauge fixed action still has some residual nilpotent odd global symmetry called BRST symmetry, which involves the fields and the ghosts. So this is how it will act. Schematically, the BRST symmetry will act on the original fields in the problem by doing a gauge transformation. This little delta here means gauge transformation. A gauge transformation of the original fields proportional to some gauge parameter C. This C is the same C as over here. The BRST symmetry of the ghosts will look like this. The transformation will act like that. The auxiliary field just dies, and this anti-field just turns into B. Okay? And then what you do when you're studying these problems is you identify the physical theory with the cohomology of this BRST. So what you do is you know, for example, if you want to construct the Hilbert space of your theory or something like that, you essentially construct the naive Hilbert space that's constructed from like your original physical theory with its extra redundant degrees of freedom and like weird things like weird polarization modes for the A field and things like that. And then you also have these like ghost degrees of freedom, and that constructs some big Hilbert space. And then you pass to the Q cohomology, the BRST cohomology, and that is the physical Hilbert space. So this is, if you've studied string theory or something like this, this is essentially the only way to, only nice way to construct, for example, the spectrum of the string or things like that. Yes?
So how much of this is still true when I have like a mixed anomaly between B and F?
B and F?
Yeah.
Between?
Yeah, between the axle and the field.
Well, this is not even a field, right?
A.
Oh, and A?
Whatever it is.
I don't think you should even ever have an anomaly between them if you started with this and you were just basically rewriting.
That's true.
Okay, so I think you wouldn't have to consider such things. So, and then the answer, if you were in such a situation, is I don't know. Okay. So what I'm going to do for this entire talk is I'm going to focus on quantum field theories that are defined in a BVBRST formalism. So I just mean that, you know, you start with some original theory called T, and it's embedded in a bigger ambient theory, T-twiddle. And that theory has ghosts and anti-ghosts. And if you're in a full BV formalism, anti-fields, etc. Essentially, the entire point of the previous slide was just to tell you that, you know, this such a situation is not exotic. It's actually very common. It's also very useful. And it's a concrete example. So this is your original theory, T. And somehow you could imagine that there was some formulation of the theory in some alternative perspective where there were also ghosts and anti-ghosts and things like that. Okay. And so when you're working in this BVBRST formalism, there's always some Grassmann odd nilpotent symmetry, QBRST. Observables in the original theory T, which are embedded in this T-twiddle, are recovered from T-twiddle by taking the QBRST cohomology. So for example, if you wanted local operators in T, they're essentially local operators in T-twiddle, and then you pass to the BRST cohomology. If you want interactions in T, you essentially take, again, operators in T-twiddle, pass to the BRST cohomology, and because interactions are integrated, it doesn't see total derivatives, so you could say, oh, you don't take the cohomology of QBRST, you take it D plus QBRST. This is all essentially a long-winded way of saying that we're going to be working in a BV formalism, but most people kind of recoil when you say BV formalism, because the only time you ever really see BV formalism, if you're not working on mathematical things, is like if you're quantizing p-form gauge theories, or theories which only close on shell, or theories with field-dependent structure constants, or some theories with some crazy complicated constraints. And so most people avoid the BV formalism, but I really want to just stress BV formalism is essentially just a synonym for BRST, but maybe with some extra flavor. Flavor's a bad word. Details. Okay.
So, say again what the formula A means.
Formula A.
What am I saying?
Eight. I'm essentially just saying when you're working in a BV formalism, you're saying that your little theory T is embedded in some ambient theory. And I'm saying, for example, that if you want operators in this theory, by definition, it's operators in the complex. Oh. Right. So technically, when you're, you know, oftentimes people think of that like that the tangent space to the space of theories are local operators because, you know, you're adding things like, I even wrote it on the previous slide this way, you're adding things like this to the action. But I mean, that's not strictly correct, because if you imagined that you added a term which was like a derivative of something else here, that would, of course, not contribute anything. So it really should be better thought of as Q plus D. Maybe one other way of saying this that might be more useful for like the mathematicians in the audience is you kind of, when you're working in a BV formalism, you kind of have some huge chain complex of fields and anti-fields and things like that. And then the real physical data at the end is you take that chain complex, you pass to Q, and then the cohomologies are like the physical things that actually show up in problems. And I should stress that this is actually an interesting perspective, not just for mathematics, but also for a physics perspective. Like the BV formalism is really nice because once you have this chain complex and you just pass to Q cohomology, you can do things like incorporate the equations of motion into the differential. So like one of the interesting things about studying, like, you know, sometimes if you're asked like, oh, what are all the local operators in some free scalar theory? Well, you'd say, oh, it's like phi, and it's like phi squared, phi cubed, d phi, d squared phi. But then you realize, oh wait, d squared phi, well, you know, d squared of phi is supposed to be zero when you use the equations of motion, so like you kind of overcount it. And so the BV formalism is a nice place to where you can actually just build this in. You can build d squared right into your differential so that when you, you know, kind of construct all your naive letters or like combinations of fields that are supposed to show up in some local operator, and then you pass the Q cohomology, it just automatically kills off the equations of motion for you. So it's not just like an abstract or niche thing to study. It's actually seems like something that's kind of underutilized.
Can I ask a really naive question? So, you know, another way I could think about this is I'd be like, I have a gauge theory, and I'm just going to like try and write everything in terms of gauging theory and operators like Wilson lines. Mm-hmm. Is there a simple way to understand the right-hand side of your equation 8 in those terms?
The answer is no. The answer is, you can formulate like the Wilson line and everything like that in terms of, let me see if I can. Okay, the answer is no, I can't do it on the spot.
The left-hand side is like gauge invariant operators and interact.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So these things over here are all like manifestly gauge invariant and everything like that. It's sort of built into the structure of the problem. I think I can't do it live. So why did I tell you all this? Well, I told you all this because I remember in our memory banks we had stored the beta function. Well, we can compute an analog of the beta function for any type of transformation. Nobody said we just had to study scale transformations. So actually, people do this all the time right now. A very popular thing right now in some realms of physics is studying non-relativistic scale transformations where you scale space and time differently. So you scale maybe t by, there should also be a lambda in front of x. So you scale it by some multiple of lambda. And so when z is equal to 2, that's kind of like doing a non-relativistic flow. You're scaling space and time asymmetrically. And so, for example, then people can ask questions like, what are the non-relativistic fixed points, if you will? What are the things that are invariant under these transformations? Another example, which is possibly contentious, is if you have a gauge theory and you have some anomalous axial symmetry, then quote unquote, doing an axial transformation on the quantum field theory is going to change the theta angle. So you could imagine that this is another form of flow on the space of theories. So in particular, if we consider T embedded into this T twiddle with QBRST, so it's embedded in this ambient theory described in a BRST formalism, the kind of question I'm going to be interested in is, can we deform, we want to understand deformations of T. And so to do this, we're going to look at deformations of T-twiddle that we can do without breaking BRST symmetry. So if we consider deformations of T-twiddle, we're just going to allow everything. We're going to allow Grassmann-odd couplings, things with non-trivial ghost number, right? Just anything that's totally allowed in the C-twiddle. Then just like before with the beta function, I told you that you had a formal pointed manifold of theories around T in theory space. Then around T-twiddle in this sort of ambient theory space, you're going to have a formal pointed DG supermanifold. Super because you're allowing things like these Grassmann-odd couplings, and DG because we're kind of working all cohomologically. We're working with chain complexes. So now we have a formal pointed DG supermanifold, D of T twiddle, and BRST symmetry can be encoded in a vector field which I call the eta function, which looks like this, analogous to the beta function. And just like the beta function, the linear term tells us if adding an interaction calligraphic I explicitly or classically violates BRST symmetry. And higher order, and when I say these things, right, if you do a series expansion of these coefficients here, and the higher order terms in this series expansion will tell you if these anomalies are generated quantum mechanically. Recall that I spoke about scheme dependence and independence of these things for the beta function. I'll come back to that at the end of the next slide. Are there, yes. Hello.
Can you remind me what is the physical meaning of BRST symmetry? Why do we want to keep it?
Right. Actually, you'll see an example in two slides. So I could tell you that what I'm going to argue is that it's a very useful perspective for tracking lots of data about the quantum field theory. And for example, things like information about anomalies and things like that will actually live in these coefficients. Much the same way that the beta function coefficients encodes things like, for example, three-point functions. These eta functions will encode data about anomalies, operator product expansions, things like that. But that's not immediately obvious here. But that will be the point. I'll show an example in a few slides. Is that okay? Or okay. Okay. So well, what's the point of all this? So recall that I've got this eta function here. Well, since it came from this Q, I'm going to stop writing QBRST. Sometimes I'll write it. Sometimes I won't. So since Q squared was equal to zero, it was nilpotent. The eta function for consistency must also square to zero. And you can think of this as some sort of West-Zimino consistency condition for the BRST symmetry. Oh, there's a typo. This gives quadratic constraints on the coefficient functions of eta ig, because, of course, you can just expand this out in terms of the coefficient functions, eta ig, and you can expand these eta ig out into a form like this. And this will give some sort of interdependencies between these coefficient functions here. And now I'm going to just pull this out of nowhere. I'm going to say, define the following multilinear operation on the spaces of interactions of your quantum field theory. So you have the spaces of all interactions of your quantum field theory, which, as we talked about with Luke, are essentially local operators modulo, you know, total derivatives. Define this operation that looks like this. So it's some sort of higher bracket. It's some sort of like analog of a Lie bracket, if you will, but it eats arbitrarily many entries, where the structure constants are the coefficients from the eta function. Then the BRST variation becomes an expression that looks like this. And it turns out that this condition up here, that eta squared was zero, these quadratic constraints on these coefficients, exactly imply that the coefficients and the brackets define an L infinity algebra on the space of interactions. So you have this complicated space of interactions, and they have these multilinear operations on them, and these multilinear operations have the structure of an L infinity algebra.
I think possibly it's
an L infinity algebra, but what you would call an N bracket might be actually EN plus one entries or something like that. It's a degree shift. It's just degree shift.
Actually, if I shift everything by one, I get it.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so for the mathematicians, maybe this is, I don't know, maybe this is exciting, maybe it's not, I don't know. So let me see, what kind of things are there? So once you realize this, for example, the statement that this interaction has no, if you add some interaction to the theory and it doesn't break BRST symmetry, there's no BRST anomalies, so then eta I must equal to zero. This thing over here becomes the Mara-Cartan equation for an L infinity algebra. And so it's essentially saying that good deformations of T twiddle, aka ones which don't violate BRST symmetry, a symmetry which should not be violated, are things that satisfy the Mara-Cartan equations. What else? I mentioned that I would comment on scheme dependence. So you could say, you could do some sort of redefinition. You could pick a different scheme, and your coefficients would be totally different. And so you'd get some totally different L infinity algebra. Of course, if you do that, it turns out you're totally right. You'll get some completely different L infinity algebra, but they will be the same in cohomology. So they won't be isomorphic, but they'll be quasi isomorphic. So you'll see that these are sort of the invariant or useful information is in this sort of quasi isomorphism class of L infinity algebras. Right. Okay. So now I want to answer sort of the question that was asked. Oh, I should mention one other thing. Maybe if you were very mathematically and geometrically inclined, you would have noticed this right from this first slide here, that there was an L infinity structure, because the definition for some folks of an L infinity algebra is the coefficients of a nilpotent odd vector field on a DG supermanifold. So you could have gone right from there, right to the slide. Some people define L infinity algebras to be complicated collections of brackets like this with complicated consistency conditions. Okay, so I want to answer the question that was asked about sort of why do we care about this and everything like that. And the answer is eta is not just abstract fun, it's computable fun. So it's not just like, I'm not just telling you there's this L infinity algebra structure that lives on the space of interactions. It's you can actually compute these coefficients, and they actually tell you interesting things. So how am I doing? Probably, all right. So correlation functions of some theory T deformed by an interaction I are essentially just correlation functions of T with an additional insertion of this shape, right? I mean, I'm being schematic, but bear with me. So this correlation function like this is essentially just like this. And so what you can do then is you can just tailor expand out the the exponential, and you can start to compute this quantity in perturbation theory from this. That's what we do all the time when we're studying anything. Okay, well, at linear order, the BRST anomaly is just generated by adding some interaction math cal I, is just going to be this, right? Because you're just computing whether or not, you know, it's trivial under Q or not. And so in general, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write, you know, the action of Q on I. I might also later in the talk write just Q acting on I without the commutator brackets written explicitly, just for the action of Q on the interaction. But anyway, I'm going to write it like this. So it's going to be equal to some linear terms plus some total derivative terms. Okay, so if I do that, then at linear order, again, I'm going to get some violation like this. And in perturbation theory, higher order terms are going to come from, sort of in this exponential, are going to come from things that look vaguely like this. But of course, when you're computing quantities like this, you need some sort of regularization to avoid UV divergences, since you're going to have things like colliding interactions and things like that. So you're going to have a whole host of UV divergences, and so you're going to need to add some sort of regulator to this, and the regulator is going to allow us to see the BRST anomaly. So I'm actually going to just do the calculation. So we can work, so we've seen the linear order. We've seen the linear order problem. So let's consider at order g squared. So at order g squared, we can regularize the deformation to something that looks like this. So we have the first interaction term, the second interaction, and then we have this coefficient out front, and this function out front is just going to be some function which regularizes the UV divergence. And then what we can do is we can compute Q by acting on the regularized interaction up here. And what we're going to find is that there's going to be, if you recall from the previous slide, there's going to be a whole bunch of naive sort of linear terms coming from this, okay? But you know, those aren't particularly interesting. So let's compute what happens with the higher order terms. So if we take a look at the terms proportional to dj in this commutator, we just, again, naively expand it out. We'll get terms that look like this, but there'll be some djs on things. We do an integration by parts, and we'll obtain an expression that looks like this. So you see, this term before would have vanished, because this term would have been a total derivative before we added this regulator. But once we add the regulator, this term is no longer vanishing. When you integrate by parts, this term is here. It catches the d, and so you have this non-vanishing term. If we pick a particular choice of regulator function, let's say a sharp cutoff, you know, some point splitting scheme, so I choose f epsilon to essentially be a function that's zero if x1 minus x2 is less than epsilon or one otherwise, then this integral here essentially turns into an integral of sort of the boundary that I've carved out around the ball. I'm just explaining an integral for folks. Hopefully this is all clear. So essentially it turns into some integral around a ball around one of the points. And so what I find is that sort of this second order curly bracket, this curly bracket with two i's, is essentially I j plus j I. Recall again that j was this total derivative term, which naively would have vanished, but now because I'm excising a ball in a region of spacetime when the points get really close to each other, that integral, that total derivative term has something to integrate and actually catch. And so this I bracket I becomes this expression here. And if you recall, like, I know people here study like anomalies and things like that, and so people don't like this perspective anymore, but I think in ancient times people used to say things like, anomalies occur because you can't pick a regularization scheme that this is essentially an example of such a calculation. And if you haven't heard that slogan, that's probably an okay place to forget it, I guess. So, okay, I've come up with this big long expression, but I don't know, I promised still something concrete a while ago. So let me show you something very concrete you can do with this. So consider a 2D matter theory, I'm just going to call it S matter, with G global symmetry and G gauge theory. So this is my G gauge theory, and this is the theory with G global symmetry. I haven't coupled them at all. Okay, so for example, you can imagine free fermions with current that looks like this, okay? And then I'm going to study the interaction, MathCal I, that's just an A wedge J interaction that just couples this gauge theory sector to this matter sector. Okay, well then we can, I promise that you only need Peskin and Schroeder to do this. So we can add ghosts and auxiliary fields embedding T into this big ambient theory. And it's literally actually the exact way that I showed you a few slides ago. It's the, you know, you add C ghost, maybe auxiliary fields. And then we can check, how does a BRST transformation act on curly I? Curly I is A wedge J. A BRST transformation first hits the A, turns it into this piece times J, plus by Leibniz A times this. This is how it acts on J. You do some you do some cancellations here, right? This is going to be little d mu of C plus A, blah, blah, blah. And you'll end up with this term here. If you look at this term here, it's a total derivative. It's actually exactly of the form that I promised here. So actually, these terms are all zero. It doesn't have, it doesn't break BRST symmetry at the linear order, but there's some total derivative term. Just so we're clear, this D is only acting on C, but it's a total derivative because D of J is zero, because this J is the current. Okay, so we see that I is BRST closed up to that total derivative term, CJ. And so this term can potentially cause a BRST anomaly, I'm going to say. Okay?
So I have a question.
Yes.
Is BRST anomaly terrible or good? I mean, if you want to cancel it.
I mean, it depends. So for example, here, it's essentially saying that there's a gauge anomaly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to be phrased that way. So I'll come back to an example where it's not phrased that way. It's actually the exact same example, but done in a different order. But yeah, that's a great question. So now I can use my abstract formula, which I obtained earlier. I just plug in A, J plus J, I. So it looks like this. It's a straightforward calculation. I mean, if this is like, you know, standard 2D CFT, we know that none of these terms, I just contract terms. The only thing that actually has non-trivial OPE is JJ terms. So that'll give something which diverges like X12 squared. So now I've got AC times these JJ OPE. So it diverges like 1 over Z squared. I don't know why I'm drawing on the board. It diverges like 1 over Z squared. And so then you do a Cauchy integral formula or something like that. It's going to essentially turn into derivatives of this term. And so up to some normalization factors, this bracket II is just CDA. And these combinatorial factors out here are going to be related to all the representation theoretic factors, you know, factors of 2 pi, but most importantly, representation theoretic factors. So this term out front could be zero. And in fact, if you were computing it in some theory where the matter content was chosen to so that there was no gauge anomaly, this coefficient out here would be zero. But in general, it's just some number. Okay, and so indeed, we recover essentially the well-known one-loop anomaly for G-gauge theory. If you take AJ and it's the bracket of AJ with AJ, you get this quantity here. And indeed, if you did this exact same calculation in 2 times K dimensions, you would recover an anomaly from a K plus 1 area bracket. So you'd recover basically the F wedge F, et cetera, terms. So that's an example of how it's computable and how it contains, for example, anomaly information. And so just as a quick recap, since I'm at 45 minutes, don't worry, you'll all be free soon, is that deformations are integral to our understanding of quantum field theory. If we work in a BVBRST formalism, we can introduce a vector field called eta that tracks the violation of BRST symmetry due to interactions. And this eta defines an L-infinity algebra on the space of interactions. And the Mara-Cartan equation for that L-infinity algebra is essentially solved by the well-defined deformations. And eta contains useful information like anomalies. And if you're familiar with twisted SQFTs, another example of places where these brackets show up is in descent operations. So for example, I don't know how many folks are familiar with these SQFTs, but in twisted SQFTs, in twisted supersymmetry, you know, you have some local operators and then you have things which are like descendants of local operators. They're kind of what happens when you take the local operator and smear it a little, it becomes non-local and things like that. And so there become sort of collections of higher operations. So the one operation everybody knows, the one two-area product that everybody knows is the OPE in, you know, you collide two local operators. But another example of an operation in a topologically twisted theory is called like secondary product, where you kind of take one of the operators, you smear it around a ball, and you kind of smear that, it's like a one form, you integrate that one form over some ball around your original operator, and that produces another type of local operator. So there are many types of two-way brackets. And just as a highlight for one of the papers is one of my collaborators and their collaborator computed, for example, higher central charges, like these A and C anomalies of 4D Suzy gauge theories using this bracket technology. So you can compute some interesting things from these brackets. And I'd like to point out that lots of the things in this that I've presented already can be generalized. So for example, you could have considered, instead of just interactions, you could have considered position-dependent interactions. So now at the vertices, you can have some amount of, you know, inflow, some momentum coming in at each vertex. These brackets go from being brackets on the space of interactions to like the space of interactions labeled by a little p, where momentum pi can come in at that interaction point, and then they become operations from collections of interactions with momentum pi flowing in to an interaction where the total momentum pi is in at the point. And this kind of reflects the fact that there's a colored operad structure living underneath all of this, and it's a colored by momentum. So if you're familiar with these words, that's a great example. And if not, then you just get more complicated brackets. There's a sort of a distinguished subcase that I'd like to point out that shows up in the Suzy literature, which are holomorphic quantum field theories with holomorphic momentum, lambda, flowing in. And these recover what are called lambda brackets, or higher N Lie or homotopy conformal algebras. These show up, for example, even in 2D VOAs. So if you read Katz's book on 2D VOAs, you'll find that there's these lambda bracket structures, which are important for carry some important information about the chiral algebra. And you can also generalize all the previous discussion to be about auxiliary or defect systems. So for example, the brackets of some theory T, you can take some brackets of some theory T and compute them, and they'll contain some data. But you can also compute the brackets of T with some probe theory, and that will help you extract information about the original theory T, because the brackets of this sort of product theory will have information about T that you might not just be able to naively see from T. So a concrete example that answers, again, a question that was asked earlier is we could imagine that exact same theory example from earlier, where we imagine we want to study just this matter theory, S matter. And so what I do is I imagine the gauge theory is like a probe theory for this S matter. And when we compute the brackets there, we essentially are seeing that the matter theory had an Atuft anomaly, right? The gauge anomaly, when it was engaged, was an Atuft anomaly of this S matter theory. And we actually show some examples in the paper. For example, if T is a topological quantum mechanics, the brackets that we compute of T recover the Moyal commutator. And if you take the theory T and couple it to just one auxiliary, like add one auxiliary 1D fermion, the brackets with just the fermionic T probe theory added give you enough information to recover the full Moyal star product of T. So you basically recover all the information of T by just using the two-airy bracket of T itself and the two-airy bracket with one fermion added. So quite a lot of information, essentially all the information of T is just in these brackets. And there's also generalizations to 1D topological defects, and their brackets have some sort of A infinity structure associated with them. I won't go into the details, but because I'd like to move on to sort of the natural end of the talk. Okay, we're doing okay. Are there questions? Is this yes, no, maybe? Okay. So I'll just end by talking about holomorphic topological theories, and I'm going to be extremely schematic now. So I went from doing live calculations to being extremely schematic because I just like to flash some results, but they're a little bit complicated. And this is largely related and inspired by the previous papers in the series. So by holomorphic topological theory, I mean consider flat spacetime, but it has the structure of C to the H times R to the T. So it's got coordinates like XC, X bar C, and XR. And by holomorphic topological, I mean anti-holomorphic translations in CH and translations in RT are essentially gauge symmetries. They're BRST exact. So obviously such theories are actually quite commonplace in our lives. For example, any topological theory, of course. Chiral algebras are a great example. You could also imagine mixed scenarios. So you could imagine a bulk system with a boundary. So the bulk is a 3D TFT, but the boundary has some chiral algebra structure, things like that. Or you could also imagine even mixed scenarios where the bulk theory has one topological direction and then one complex, so one anti-holomorphic, one holomorphic direction. Okay? And I'm generically interested in theories with an action that looks like this. Okay? So in this perspective, I will sometimes refer to phi as a superfield, and the coordinates dxr and dx bar c are like superspace coordinates because they're never going to show up in any answer. Because of the BRST exactness. If you don't like me calling them superspace coordinates, just imagine that my fields are forms, and those forms are forms in dx to the r and dx bar to the c. Okay, and such theories and such holomorphic topological theories and such actions appear, like I mentioned, in Chern-Simons theory and things like that. And more generally, or not more generally, but a special case that is of interest to me is they appear in holomorphic topological twists of supersymmetric theories. So in supersymmetric theories, you may recall that, right, in SQFTs, you have the Susi algebra. And the Susi algebra has some piece that looks like, you know, there's some anti-commutators that look like QQ bar is equal to a translation. And the supercharges will often square to zero. And so what you'll do is supercharges square to zero. And so what you can do is you can study the supersymmetric theory, but instead of studying the whole theory at once, you can just study it in the cohomology of this operator Q, because Q is essentially a differential. So you can pass the cohomology of this operator Q, and you study sort of a restricted subsector of your original theory. And because there are often other supercharges, Q bars, say, such that the Q of them is P, then those translations P essentially do nothing, because they are Q exact. They're the Q of Q bar. So in summary, supersymmetric theories, if you kind of restrict yourself to some BPS subsectors, the correlation functions in those BPS subsectors are often holomorphic or topological or some mixture of those two. They don't depend on position, for example. That's not important. It's just a fun example. Fun example of such theories. So in such theories, we're going to be interested in brackets of the following form. So it's some n airy bracket where holomorphic momentum lambda 1 flows in at vertex 1, dot, 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 all the way to vertex n minus 1. And then, of course, at the nth vertex, it's got to have the one that's compatible with momentum conservation. And I won't go into the details in lieu of time, and also because it would be a talk on its own. But the Feynman integrals that show up in computing these brackets will generically take some big form like this. Now, this looks spooky, but it's actually not, right? This is just saying you integrate over all of space, and you integrate over every position a vertex can take. But you use translation symmetry, and that throws away one vertex. You fix a vertex. These are, of course, all the insertions of all the vertices. And these are this is the momentum that's flowing in at each point. And then this is just saying there's a propagator. There's a propagator for each edge of the graph. Okay? And I'm not going to go through all the details, but we can count the form degree of this integrand. It's an easy exercise. So we have, again, something like c to the h times r to the t, and we have gamma 0 minus 1 copies. This is the number of vertices. We have gamma 0 to the minus 1 copies of it. If you look at the previous action on the previous slide, and you're really fast at these things, you'll see that a propagator is essentially a h plus t minus 1 form. And so you see that we have h plus t times gamma 0 minus 1 integration variables. And we have gamma 1 minus 1 propagators, which are h plus t minus 1 forms. And then you may have noticed there's a little d in here. I'm not going to explain where it comes from. But then we also have one h plus t form. And so if you just want this thing to not vanish, it's got to, of course, have the right form degree. And when you compute the form degrees, you actually find out that the only graphs that can actually have a non-vanishing contribution, the only integrals that are non-vanishing, turn out to be a well-studied class of graphs called Lamann graphs. So here's an example of Lamann graphs that show up when the number of holomorphic plus topological directions is 2. These are the ones that were classically studied, so I would call them 2 Lamann graphs because they show up in HT theories that have H plus T is equal to 2. And the reason that they were studied before is, you know, they have very interesting properties about their configuration spaces and things like that. So you can imagine that if each of these graph edges was a rigid rod of a fixed length, and each of these vertices was a little hinge, The Lehmann graphs are the graphs which are totally rigid. So, you know, if you know any civil engineering, apparently you might have encountered these things before. So I'll show you, so a graph that's so you could imagine that this triangle graph, if you pushed on it, it wouldn't bend or anything, even though its vertices are made out of hinges. But if you imagined you had a square graph that looked like this, and you just poked it over here, it would just fall over, right? So there's some degrees of freedom in the square, but not in the triangle. And what you find is that the Feynman diagrams and the integrals associated to them satisfy infinite collections of geometric identities related sort of like to their configuration spaces that essentially turn out to be the quadratic relations of those brackets from earlier. So these identities imply the higher associativity of the accompanying brackets in a diagram by diagram way. So it's not like, yeah, it's quite a nice cancellations. It's somehow stronger than the statement about the brackets, or at least equivalent. And in some of our previous work, we actually showed that you can bootstrap at least up to three loops in these examples, all the Feynman integrals that show up in these theories from these identities. So you get some sort of identities between the integrals. So you imagine there's some procedure for taking the integral associated to a graph, I'll call it I gamma 1, and you can turn it into a differential operator, which I'll just call curly D gamma 1. And then there's some other integral called I gamma 2. And you get collections of identities which sum over graphs, gamma 1 and gamma 2, with identities that look like a differential gamma 1 acting on the integral gamma 2 is equal to 0. And those are the forms of these quadratic identities. And somehow these quadratic identities actually appear to be strong enough to start being able to reverse engineer these integrals. And again, we checked it all the way up to three loops in this particular case. So they're quite strong. And then in lieu of time, I guess it kind of worked out very nicely. I won't show the proof, but you can essentially give a completely diagrammatic proof of the following statement, that if you're working in a holomorphic topological theory, and the theory has two or more topological directions, you can give a completely combinatorial proof of the fact that there's essentially no perturbative corrections to quantities in the holomorphic topological theory. The proof is a lot of fun. So you essentially relate, you know, the graphs that show up in a theory only depend on the quantity H plus T. And so what you can do is you can relate graphs in the theory with H T greater than or equal to 2 to graphs in a theory with H plus 1 T minus 2 directions. So you can somehow imagine theories with this many directions, a holomorphic theory with two or more topological directions, as being actually a deformation of a theory with one more holomorphic direction and two missing topological directions. And so you can make some sort of arguments about compatibility between the graphs that show up here, because these graphs will of course be of a different degree, H plus T minus 1 graphs, and these ones will be H plus T graphs, and you can show that there's essentially no way that anything that is a loop graph here could be consistent with coming from this theory here. So I won't go into the details, but this essentially leads to a proof of that. So I'll just wrap up. So the final recap is that I tried to explain just basic examples of deformations in quantum field theory that we're familiar with, like beta functions. I introduced the concept of an eta function, and we saw that interactions sort of have an L infinity algebra structure, and it comes from this eta function, and this tracks violations of BRST symmetry by interactions. The eta function data, the coefficients, contained familiar things like anomalies, and I tried to relate it to twisted SQFTs, but if you hadn't seen them before, it's all right. We can just black box that. I didn't really get much time to talk about OPE data, but there's some OPE data that also lives in these eta functions. I mentioned that in the holomorphic topological case, the brackets are extremely strongly constrained by the concept, because the only graphs that show up are these Lehmann graphs, and they're extremely constraining. These Lehmann graphs satisfy a whole bunch of relations that look like this, and they can be used to prove the associativity relations of the brackets, and they also, you know, prove various relationships about just integrals more generally. And then again, those things can be used to show that when there are two or more topological directions, that there are no perturbative corrections to your theory. So I'll just end here, and thanks for listening.
there are questions? If not, let me start. This T larger than two, is that related to formality?
Yeah, it's a generalization of it, yeah. Yeah, so.
So formality is a consequence of that, or is it?
It would be like, okay. So for me, like formality theorem, like Okuntsevich means no perturbative corrections when T is exactly equal to two topological directions.
I mean, for me means that T is equivalent to E and four. Something like that. I mean, somehow you can, there are no structures to T formation of T and I, so
right. So, okay. Yes, it is like that, and also you can have lambda brackety things, I would say.
So you constructed an infinity brackets from the BRC cohomology, right? Or it's associated to that.
Yes.
So is there any relationship between this infinity algebra and the infinity algebra, factorization algebra stuff?
Which one?
The infinity factorization algebra stuff in Spellberg-Williams?
It's all directly related to that.
You did mention modal product, which is kind of like a deformation quantization where you want to find a star product, essentially.
Yes.
A star B minus B star A.
Yeah, yeah.
Approximately your bracket. Like you want to do something like this?
Yeah. I want to say it's related to the work of Costello and William, but I probably can't spell out the details for you
okay.
Here now. Is there another? I saw in blue. Right.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, sorry.
Something went wrong. So, you know, you showed how you get, you know, for example, these sort of the theta F anomaly. Okay. But, like, so I guess I was curious, like, have you found, you know, can you use this to find new anomalies that maybe, you know, are there examples of stuff that was unexpected that comes out of this?
So the answer is we have not tried to use this to look for like new anomalies like that, in the way you're suggesting. I see no reason to believe you couldn't do that. And I'll highlight again the work by one of my co-authors where, I mean, they computed, for example, these higher central charges of Forty gauge theories using this formalism. And I don't know if they found any new if they computed any new A and C anomalies that hadn't been computed before. I'd have to double check, I'd have to ask. But they definitely do it in a simpler way than what had done that before, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of the spirit of the question is like, if you don't know what you're looking for,
right.
Is it still kind of falls out neatly? Or is this a case of, you know, you sort of know where to look and then you find it?
No, so here's one concrete application, is that one thing that, so, okay, here's a concrete application that's not looking for anomalies, but an application of this formalism. So if you, in this earlier paper here, we use sort of these techniques to essentially calculate what happens to, if you took some supersymmetric quantum field theory, a natural question to ask are like, what are its, like, let's say you have an n equals 1 theory, what are its quarter BPS operators or something like that. And you can compute that classically, but then quantum mechanically, there's various like supersymmetric anomalies which kind of change what things look quarter BPS, and you can use this formalism that I just described to essentially systematically compute the corrections to this space of local operators, and that hadn't been done before. And I mean, people are using these techniques now to understand, for example, BPS states in n equals 4 Cyprian mills, things like that. So, are there other?
Not to drag you here, if you don't want to talk about it, but can you briefly say where you can read off OPE data from the eta function?
Right. I said. So it's maybe not like, of course, it's possible that like all OPE data is maybe somewhere in here, but there were kind of guises of it in various points. So perhaps, okay. you know, the easiest one is maybe if you're interested in the operator in the OPEs of operators in these twisted SQFTs, then essentially they are the various two array brackets. But yeah, it would be maybe a bit of time to explain that. I'm sorry, Rokas.
Yeah, okay.
Other questions?
I mean, I have a quick question about the differential equations behind you.
Okay.
Is it like the sum over all gamma ones and gamma twos, or?
Is it a sum over like all the gammas, or?
Yes.
No. So, okay. So essentially, what happened? I can actually draw you a picture very fast. So I showed you that this graph here was Lamann, but this graph was not Lamann. So it turns out that what will happen is there will essentially be, but you can see it's sort of 1 degree of freedom away from being a Lamann graph. It's like rigid if you got rid of one leg. So what it turns out is that if you take all graphs that are almost Lamann, they will have a differential identity, or they'll have an identity related to them. And the identity will essentially look like this. So you'll go to the graph, so there'll be an identity related to the square graph. And then you'll go to the square graph and you'll take a look at all subgraphs. So you'll take a look at a subgraph, so one subgraph just removes an edge. And you notice that if you remove an edge is Lamann, and the remaining graph, if you contracted it down, so you imagine you took that edge and you shrunk it down to a point, the remaining graph is a triangle. And so what you'll see is that you'll basically take a look at all ways to sum over all of those subgraphs inside the square. So let me call the subgraph S inside the square, and then this is the remaining graph, so I'll call it square minus S graph, and you'll take the identity, the integral associated to this subgraph, and the integral associated to this subgraph, and there'll be some sort of calculations that'll go between them and sum up to zero. So it's not over all graphs, but it has something to do with the structure of subgraphs of the almost Lamann graphs. But the details are a little involved.
Any other questions?
Are you considering the deformations only by local operators or also by non-local operators?
So you mean like, for example, what are kind of interactions am I adding? My interactions are, I mean, they're non-local in the sense that they're like, they're super fields in the sense that, you know, they have this dx bar to the c, dx r. If you remember, I said that the things were, they're non-local in the sense that they're like super fields valued in these forms. Does that help?
Okay, yeah. I think I meant like before when you were explaining everything about the eta function and this space of theories. Like, is there something special about deformation by local operators?
No. I'm kind of working again with all these things in BV formalism. So of course there's local operators, and then there's like these kind of like descendants of them.
But. From the equation, it seems like it's a non-local deformation. It's built out of a local operator integrated,
mm-hmm.
but it's a non-local deformation. So it was never local to begin with. Is what I'm trying to say.
It's a local quantum. The deform theory is a local quantum field theory.
What Adrian is saying is that you integrate this deformation over all of space, but again, we integrated a local operator or something like that. So I don't know.
No, but I meant more of like, can you integrate it over a submanifold?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What information can you get from there? Or that's all included in what you explained?
Defect, yeah, you study defect brackets, things like that, of course, yeah. Yeah, sorry, now I understand, thank you.
Further questions to the
coffee guy? Yeah.
And then,
Justin
again.
Thanks.